But we had a mission to inform. Even under threat, we did not leave. We stayed, determined to fulfill our duty as journalists.
The head of Iran's national broadcaster says the glass building will soon be rebuilt and resume its role as a hub for journalism, stressing that the destruction only reveals Israel's desperation and the true colors of its supporters. In the charred remains of this studio, what we witness is Iranian resilience that endures despite flagrant violations of the Geneva Conventions and a direct attack on the press. Gisum Shahmadi, Tehran.
The Israeli military presses ahead with its air and artillery attacks across Gaza, killing and injuring more Palestinian civilians in its latest round of strikes. In one of the latest attacks, at least six people were killed after Israeli warplanes bombed the town of Az-Zuwaida in central Gaza. A similar strike in Al-Fayrouz neighborhood or area northwest of Gaza City killed at least five people. To the south, Israeli jets struck the tents of displaced Palestinians in Al-Mawasi area, killing five members of the same family, including children. Earlier on Sunday, the regime's warplanes bombed the crowded market in Gaza City's Ad-Daraj neighborhood, killing at least a dozen civilians. A consultant general surgeon at the Al-Ahli Baptist Hospital, Dr. Ahmad Qandil, was amongst the victims. The ongoing Israeli genocide, which began in October 2023, has so far killed more than 58,000 Palestinians. Over 138,500 others have also been injured. We earlier talked to our Gaza correspondent Moti Abu Musabbe to get the latest updates on the Israeli attacks across the blockaded territory. Let's take a listen.
According to the medical sources, the tragic death toll of the Palestinian people has surpassed 100 Palestinian civilians. The bulk of them were women and children. After the Israeli occupation forces intensified their brutal airstrikes and attacks against the Palestinian people in all areas of Gaza Strip, and as you know, several appalling massacres were committed today as a result of those intensified and accelerated airstrikes and attacks. And let me start with Gaza City, particularly Az-Zaytun neighborhood, which witnessed several horrific and brutal attacks carried out by the Israeli occupation forces over the past couple of hours. According to multiple eyewitnesses, at least five residential buildings were pounded by the Israeli warplanes in that area, and several Palestinian debris were seen scattering in all areas of the neighborhood because, you know, the Palestinian medical staff and the Palestinian civil defense teams are still unable to reach that area as a result of the tragic situation there, because the Israeli occupation forces are attacking whoever moves in the area. So this reveals clearly how the Israeli occupation forces are still escalating their attacks against the eastern side of Gaza City in particular. Needless to mention that the Israeli warplanes are still ongoing against At-Tufah neighborhood as well, because over the past couple of hours, the Israeli warplanes also carried out several brutal airstrikes.
Two UN agencies have raised a serious alarm about the severe malnutrition threatening the lives of thousands of children in Gaza amid the ongoing Israeli blockade of the territory. The United Nations Children's Fund said over 5,800 children were diagnosed with malnutrition in June alone, more than 1,000 of whom suffered from severe acute malnutrition. It described the situation as a child survival emergency, urging rapid aid delivery to the people of Gaza. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, also warned of a sharp rise in malnutrition cases in Gaza, particularly amongst children and other vulnerable groups. UNRWA said it has recorded a significant surge in malnutrition cases since the tightening of the Israeli blockade in March. It called for global efforts to ensure the delivery of life-saving supplies and an end to the worsening humanitarian crisis. According to Palestinian health officials, malnutrition has claimed the lives of at least 67 children, while over 650,000 children under the age of 5 are at immediate risk of acute malnutrition. An Israeli plan to relocate Gaza's population to a closed zone near the Egyptian border has drawn sharp condemnations from both Palestinians and the international community. The plan was unveiled last Monday by Israel's Minister of Military Affairs. It envisions building a closed zone in southern Gaza during a potential 60-day ceasefire in the territory, which is currently under negotiations in Qatar. According to Israel Katz, Gaza's entire population of over 2 million people will be eventually displaced to the so-called humanitarian city. In response, Hamas rejected the plan, calling it a preparation for forcibly displacing Palestinians to Egypt or other countries. The Palestinian Authority also dismissed the plan, saying it has nothing to do with humanity. The UN Agency for Palestinian Refugees condemned the idea as a massive concentration camp for Palestinians. The plan is also under fire in Israel. On Friday, a group of 16 Israeli law scholars warned in a letter to the regime's officials that the plan could amount to a war crime. Political analyst Jim Kavanaugh joined us earlier to discuss the impact of Israel's relocation plan on the livelihood of Palestinians in Gaza. Let's see what he had to say.
You are absolutely correct. This is a cruel, gratuitous cruelty. It's absurd that anybody would ever suggest it in 2025. Even as you say, Israeli scholars are against it. I saw former Prime Minister Ehud Olmert was saying, well, this could be ethnic cleansing. Well, you think so? That's exactly what it is. But this is the plan all along, to kill and expel the Palestinians from Gaza. Okay, this humanitarian city is a concentration camp. They are saying people who don't go into the city are fair game. They're going to be killed because they're going to be presumed terrorists, etc., if they're not in the city. Once they get in the city, they cannot leave except by, you know, leaving forever and with no permission to come back. And they're going to create a situation where it's going to be impossible for all those people to live anyway. They're going to have the same kind of nonsense they have with these food distribution networks, where you're not going to get any food. You're going to have to be running through gunfire to get it. And people are going to want to leave. That's what they're going to do. People want an end to the being
The Freedom Flotilla vessel Handala has made its way to the Gaza Strip as part of its mission to challenge the long-standing Israeli blockade of the coastal Palestinian territory. The ship, loaded with humanitarian aid, was cheered by hundreds of people at the port of Saracusa. Handala is the third ship that has been sent by the coalition to break the Israeli regime's siege of Gaza this year. Max Civilli has filed this report.
The coalition of pro-Palestine activists Freedom Flotilla has launched the vessel Handala from Italy on a journey towards the Gaza Strip. The vessel set sail from the port of Syracuse on the southeastern coast of Sicily with its load of humanitarian aid and with an 18-member crew of various nationalities.
We cannot be at peace with ourselves if we don't do something to stop the genocide in Gaza. We must help our suffering brothers and sisters.
We know it's our historical duty to do so. The situation in Gaza is getting worse and worse each day, with the genocide and ethnic cleansing advancing, part of an 8-decade project, but now advancing with the complicity and the silence of the governments all around the world. So when governments fail, we sail.
Crew members said that this Freedom Flotilla's mission is dedicated to the children of Gaza, with the vessel named in honor of Handala, the iconic Palestinian cartoon figure. The Handala vessel carries not only supplies but also a message of solidarity from people around the world who refuse to remain silent in the face of the ongoing slaughter of children in Gaza.
My parents taught me to support the Palestinian people when I was a child, and now more than ever, we have to stand by them. We must stop the ongoing genocide and the killing of the children in Gaza.
The Handala vessel will make a stop in the city of Gallipoli in the Puglia region before continuing its path towards the besieged Gaza Strip. The Freedom Flotilla Coalition has decided to make a stop in Puglia because the local government there broke off relations with Israel last month in protest over the Netanyahu regime's genocide in Gaza, the first region in Italy to do so. Freedom Flotilla Coalition's mission comes after the Israeli forces attacked two other vessels carrying humanitarian aid over the past months. In May, the Conscience was struck twice by Israeli armed drones about 20 kilometers off the coast of Malta, while in early June, the Israeli forces intercepted Madleen about 180 kilometers from Gaza and international waters, abducting and detaining all 12 crew members for 4 days. Handala embarks on this journey under the shadow of these Israeli crimes. Max Civili, Siracusa.
We earlier talked to Robert Inlakesh to get more details on Israel's settlement plans across the occupied West Bank. Let's take a listen.
Plan to annex the West Bank, primarily looking at areas in the Jordan Valley, Area C, which is about 60% of the entirety of the West Bank, but also some areas in Area B. You've just noted the settlement expansion in the north around Tubas and areas as well cutting closer to Jenin. In order to annex this territory, what they've got to do is carve up the north, the middle, and the south of the West Bank and divide it with checkpoints, new roads, fences, and they've been doing this. And roadblocks, of course, as well. That's been happening for pretty much every village in the West Bank has a roadblock, these bollards and gates placed on their villages to stop them from entering and exiting when the Israelis choose to simply lock these gates or push these cement blocks in front of the roads. The goal of this is to cut off all of the different communities from each other to make it impossible for Palestinians to commute between the different villages, the cities, to make life unbearable.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
Chased by wolves, followed by a hawk. On the battlefield, you took your final walk. It took my breath when you said goodbye. But then again, heroes never die. Your final words were stay the course. Trust in God, the everlasting source. Don't give in to the enemy's plots. Resist with faith, go against the odds. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power. Until the last breath, you never surrender. Unshakable faith, unwavering sacrifice. Make you the hero we'll remember forever. Your blood was spilled, but it nourished my roots. I then became a tree with many fruits. The fruits are love, courage, and resolve. You've made me a soldier, so you I salute. Your way I follow, oh my hero. Unbreakable soul, unstoppable power. Until the last breath, you never surrender.
viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
And God said, let there be light. And there was light.
The Creator made Adam in his image, then placed the world in his care. May you walk alongside the Creator in righteousness.
God of Abraham, take my child into thy hands, that he may live to thy service.
God has spoken to us before, through Abraham, Noah, Moses, and through Jesus Christ. Why should we be so surprised that God speaks to us now through Muhammad?
Viewpoint. A critique of movies with religious themes.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of God, welcome to another edition of the program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio. With me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program. And my guest speakers, my friends here in the studio, sitting with me, giving me their contribution to the critique of this program or the movies that we're going to focus on or criticize. I start with Sayyid Abdullah. Assalamu alaikum and welcome to the program again.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah and thank you for having me as always.
You're welcome. And Brother Yasser, my friend, assalamu alaikum, greetings to you and welcome to the program again.
Alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah wa barakatuh. Always a pleasure being with you, Brother Muhammad Jawad.
Thank you very much. One of the movies actually with a spiritual theme is called If I Stay. It is produced in actually 2014, directed by R.J. Cutler, featuring actors and actresses such as Chloe Grace Moretz, Jamie Blackley, and so on and so forth. The Google users actually, 63% of them liked this movie. The IMDb gave this 6.7 out of 10, the approval rate, while Rotten Tomatoes gave it only 36%. However, there's another one which is called Letterboxd, which gave this movie, in fact, 2.8 out of 5. The whole movie is, follows Mia Hall, a young cellist whose life changes over forever after a car accident, leaving her in a coma. She experiences an out-of-body experience reflecting on her life and the choices, in fact, she must make about her future. But before we begin with our dear guest, let's take a listen to a short part or a trailer of this movie, If I Stay, directed by R.J. Cutler, produced in 2014. And then we come back and continue our program, Viewpoints, on RIB English Radio.
I'm so crazy in love with you.
Why me?
Because I like to watch you play. You go to another place. You get this crease in your forehead right there.
Honey, you might just be staring down the barrel of greatness. So try to stay open to it. Don't go closing any doors on yourself.
So how come you never written a song for me?
I'm no good at writing about things that make me happy.
If we weren't musicians, we could just go to college together.
It's very inconvenient to fall in love at your age, especially if it's the real thing.
Promise me, no matter where you are, no matter where I am, we'll spend next New Year's together.
Isn't it amazing how life is one thing and then in an instant it becomes something else? Like here I am, Mia, the girl who thinks about the cello and Adam and Juilliard. And just like that, that could never exist again.
Welcome back to the program Viewpoints, the movie critique program on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Jawad, hosting this program, and Brother Yasser and Sayyid Abdullah, my guest speakers, helping me criticize the movie If I Stay, produced in 2014, directed by R.J. Cutler. Let me begin with you, Brother Yasser. What themes are explored in this film?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So some of the themes that I felt may have been explored in this movie, obviously the theme of death, the themes of hope, mm-hmm. the themes of uncertainty of life.
Yes.
Things like that. And that third one of the uncertainty of life was mentioned quite a few times in the movie itself, that you don't know what's going to happen, which is actually something good in terms of actually a movie actually trying to portray that. The hereafter, resurrection, you know, fighting, for example, and so on and so forth.
Yes.
So these are some of the things that were shown. Family, the concept of family was also
the value
also
of family.
Family values. The two characters in the movie, you can see it completely opposite. Chasing one's dreams, for example. Again, whether good or bad is another discussion. But these are some of the themes I noticed. Some of them actually were quite good if someone was able to pick them up. But again, whatever you said, I the movie itself was quite slow. It's quite boring. But these are some of the themes that you can derive from the movie itself. Anyway, so I picked up from.
Yes, actually, especially in comparison with the fast pace of life that we today experience in the age of, you know, AI or
age of AI, age of technology.
It was
also a very predictable movie.
Right.
You knew exactly what was going to happen and so on. But
yes, thank you very much. Sayyid Abdullah, what challenges does Mia, the major character in this movie, played by Chloe Grace Moretz, in fact, face in this story? What challenges are there?
The challenges, well, based on what I saw, like your brother Yasser said, it was a quite slow movie. She was battling family, staying with her family. Because she noticed that most of her family have passed away.
Yes.
And now she has a choice where either she can join them in death or she can come back.
Mm-hmm.
So she's trying to battle the life that she lived, the memories that she had, and what life could be without her family, and the choice that she had to make if she would go through that.
Mm-hmm.
So she was just battling that choice between staying and leaving.
Yes.
And trying to see which one that brings her more fulfillment, I guess.
Mm. Yes, exactly. Actually, this very important theme, or the key concept of choice and agency, is something that is discussed very much. And we'd like to pause actually for some time, of course, after the break. Thank you very much. Let's take a short break, and then we'll be back and continue our program, Viewpoints, the Movie Critic Program on IRIB English Radio. Stay with us.
Teddy, will you wake up? Am I dying? Is that what this is?
One female's critical en route to Portland now.
Someone just talk to me. Please, just help me.
Say something, I'm giving up on you.
Poor kid's waking up an orphan. If she wakes up,
here's the secret, baby. If you live, if you die, it's all up to you.
I'll be the one.
How can I stay without mom and dad? How can I leave without Adam? How am I supposed to decide this?
Life is this big, fat, gigantic mess. But that's the beauty of it, too.
Welcome back to the program, Viewpoints, the Movie Critique Program on RIB English Radio, with me, Mohammed Jawad, hosting this program, and Sayyid Abdullah and Brother Yasser, my guest speakers, helping me criticize the movie If I Stay, produced in 2014, directed by R.J. Cutler. Brother Yasser, what role does Mia's friend Adam play in her life?
So basically, this particular individual, himself being a musician,
yes,
and obviously, you know, being her boyfriend in the movie. The movie at the end kind of shows the strength of again this. They'll show it as love, but whatever it may be, that's a different discussion. But that strength of love, the strength that okay, there's still hope in that particular love of, you know, going forward with it. There is still hope in it, that the choice that is made because of that particular love and affection that they have for one another.
Yes.
And then hopefully they can move on and create a new family.
Yes.
Together. So I think the strength is there. And obviously the tensions that come about from the very beginning of the movie till the end of the movie, it shows the ups and downs of life as it is. That there's sometimes in life where you have, you know, absolute bliss and joy, and there's those times where you are emotionally wrecked and you just don't know what to do.
Yes.
So it shows those things to a certain extent anyway. But again,
you know that we actually need some kind of moral or spiritual support sometimes in life, actually.
The movie doesn't show that. The movie doesn't indicate that at all. It just shows that this is what life is. It doesn't show that she even... So her support basically was her mom.
Ah.
Most of the time it shows that her support was her family.
Right.
So that was the support that she got many times. So one of the places that we see that after one of the first fights that she had with this particular, her boyfriend Adam, she goes home on Christmas and then her mom is there and they're eating and the mom clears the kitchen and the mom starts talking to her and so on and so forth. And then again the subject and the discussion of choice comes about whether she should go to this particular university, who is more important, and so on and so forth. So that is basically the crux of the movie itself in that regard, that the support that she had was her family support, more so her mom. And then it shows at the end of the movie that, you know, when her mom dies in a car accident, that it then goes to her grandfather to a certain extent. Again, family, because she asks in one of the places, oh, what should I do?
Yes.
If you remember, like when she's just sitting there and in a coma, her grandfather speaking to her and says, oh, what should I do? So again, seeking advice from the elders of the family. So I think it's good in that sense that they show family value, family support, the family structure in terms of the youngsters seeking advice from the elders, the respect of the elders, and so on and so forth. At least in a moral corrupt. But again, understand this movie was made in 2014.
Yes.
So those values may not be seen. Yeah, it's very, very unlikely that those values you'll see in society or even movie today.
Mm-hmm. I see. Thank you very much. Said Abdullah, what significant choice does Mia have to make in the movie? Well, this choice is actually the word or the concept that I told you right before the break, you know, which is becoming very important. I mean, it becomes so pivotal to humans' existence, especially we have this theme actually recurrent or reiterated by the existential philosophy, the choice and agency of human beings. So what is this choice that Mia in this movie she has to make?
I mean, based on the script of the movie itself, it didn't look like she had any choice to make anyway. Like, once you cross over, then you're pretty much running from one ward to another. That's what she was doing.
But
she couldn't even work
out of body experiences. You have a choice, right? Don't you?
I'm not sure. I've never had that experience before to say that I had a choice to come back or not. But out of body experience, usually, if you willingly extract your soul or your body, then you can willingly bring it back. But in her case, where she got hit by a car, then her soul departed, and then she couldn't even wake up herself. Main time she tried to wake up herself, she just couldn't.
Mm-hmm.
She needed that push to bring her back, which was Adam, her boyfriend, that brought her back by his song.
Mm-hmm.
So once she's on the other side, the choice is really hard because, like, I don't think there was a choice. But they made it sound or look as if she has a choice.
Mm-hmm.
Where at the end, where she was having, where her boyfriend was talking to her, and she wasn't conscious, but you know her spirit was there, and he was saying to her, "Come back." And she's like, "No, no, I'm not coming. I'm not coming." As if she made up her mind that that's it. She's done. She's gonna go. And then she just, I don't know, maybe felt more emotional towards Adam that
you
brought
know,
her back.
I remember one of my friends, actually, he wasn't a mystic, but he experienced one of these out-of-body experiences. And he said it's becoming extremely difficult, actually, to go back to your old, body.
Old body?
Because, yeah,
when you experience
the other side, it's actually an insurmountable pleasure that you experience.
Yeah.
Right? And that's why sometimes he said to me, that this is his quote, I'm not going to extend or generalize his case, this case story actually to all.
Yeah.
But the thing is that he said that because it's really difficult actually to describe the other world, you know, and even it doesn't come in like in words. I mean, like the words cannot fulfill the or express the feelings that could be, in fact, experienced in the other realm.
Yeah.
Right. And he said it becomes so difficult because it's like pure pleasure. You cannot imagine what I'm talking about. Right. And this is where sometimes the place where Satan can tempt you to stay or to go forward, you know, unprepared, maybe. All right? Yeah. And although you're like pulled back to your body one way or another.
Yes, sir. Yeah, so obviously the spirit itself, or the soul itself, once it leaves the body, it sees and feels without limitations.
Yes.
Because the body itself is limited. Mm-hmm. Our senses are limited.
Yes.
So once the soul leaves, it can see and beyond and feel and get the pleasure beyond the human
physical
body, the physical body. So this is what your friend was talking about.
Yes. Thank you very much, Sir Abdullah and Brother Yasser, for your nice contributions to program Viewpoints, the movie critic program on IRIB English Radio. Of course, we haven't come to the the conclusion, and we didn't finish criticizing the movie If I Stay, produced in 2014, directed by R.J. Cutler, and we are going to pick up where we left off, inshallah, in the upcoming episodes. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Please, I just want to feel you touch me.
I'm not dumb enough to think that I can fix what happened.
You can't.
But I'll do anything.
I can't love you.
With everybody gone, it might be too hard for you to keep fighting. But I want you to live.
You wrote me a song.
You're my own, Mia. Stay.
Say something.
Bustle of life. The sound of living. Only sound will endure.
Hello.
IRIB English Radio.
She heard the explosions, but instead of running for her life, she stayed put, calm and composed, to broadcast the message that shook the world. Welcome to today's program, where we have with us that messenger, that Iranian journalist and anchor, Sahar Imami, to find out where that powerful message came from and how.
آنچه که ملاحظه کردید، صدایی که شنیدید، فضای غبارآلوده استودیو.
Now, on the day of the explosion, you had heard warnings about potential terrorist attacks on the IRIB. Now, what made you decide to stay that day, and what happened?
You know something? I'm only used to asking my questions, not answering them. So it's kind of difficult. I've never taken any classes on anchorship and presenting. I've always told my colleagues that when the red tally light is turned on, it feels as though I'm no longer in complete control of my words. As a presenter, you know that one needs to focus and study. I too study a lot. I'm in a news environment and I'm updated with news and events that occur on a daily, weekly, and monthly basis. In all these years, I've always tried to stay up to date. In regards to what happened that day, if you paid attention, I was reciting a statement. I'm talking about this for the first time. I was in the middle of reciting a statement live on the news channel, and when the first explosion happened, I didn't stop. I finished reciting the statement, as was my media responsibility as a professional, and since I understood that I should not cause concern in the hearts of my audience. I felt as though a transcendent power was guiding me through it, something beyond one's imagination. We're all soldiers of media. We're all ready to serve our duty in various situations, just like fighters in the battleground, and lead the way in the news and information arena. You know that at such times, your voice and demeanor becomes stronger. That day, I felt as though with every explosion that I heard, I was becoming stronger than before. At the time, we had been warned for our safety and accommodations were arranged. My manager was also one of the few present in the control room. The security warnings had already been issued by those in charge. At the same time, we were supposed to broadcast live with the next guest moments later. The station's manager told us that from that moment on, all of us had the choice to immediately evacuate the building, and it was not up to him to instruct us to stay. He said, "Make up your minds fast." At that moment, I imagined the story I had been told since my very childhood. The moment in which Imam Hussein creates a condition for his companions to leave him alone in Karbala and save their own lives. That story gave me the strength to say that I will stay. When the people's representative, Dr. Manon Raisi, heard this, he said, "Well, if you stay, I will also stay, as I'm a representative of the people and I should also stay by your side." Mrs. Abedini also stayed on the other side, and so did my other colleague, Mr. Saderi. When the program started, they handed me the statement. Since the statement was a picture of the original and not quite clear, I stumbled a couple of times. My manager told me that we'd come back to the statement moments later so that I recited perfectly. I don't remember at which point, but as I was reciting the statement, the first attack took place. I heard the first explosion, then the second, then the third, and then you saw what happened. I believe having been able to carry on like that was a result of God's mercy on me, as He's blessed me with faith and as a result of the spiritual support and prayers of Lady Fatima, the daughter of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, to whom I owe everything I have in my life. And I'm very grateful that the result was dignified.
So you have a 5-year-old and an 8-year-old. So one would think that as a mom, you would immediately rush back home when there was any danger to make sure that you could stick around to raise your kids.
It's my duty to serve as a role model for my kids. Over the years, whenever we were at a sensitive situation, I've appeared on camera stronger than other times because I believe that my power, my resolve, and my courage should serve as a model for young women watching me. My hijab, my modesty should serve as a model for young women who are perhaps on the verge of choosing their path. I've always tried to serve as a strong mother for my children. I've never told them not to cry, but I've taught them to be strong and brave. I've taught them to stand up in the face of oppression. You're saying that as a mother at the time, I should have gone with my motherly instincts. But at the time, I told myself that I should give them a lasting lesson. If I'm not around one day, they should be able to be proud of their mother and the decision she made at the time.
Can you tell us a little bit about yourself, about what you wanted to do growing up, and who you looked up to?
I very much like my job. At the time of the incident, part of what happened as a result could be attributed to my passion for my job. I was one of those who achieved her childhood dreams. I had wanted to have this job, and then I got it. In the years that I was busy pursuing my career, I also got married, and with my husband's support, I was able to progress in my job despite all the events that may prevent one from success, thanks to the patience and the support of my husband and my parents. I moved from the social realm to the news realm, and I arrived at a position in which I had to serve as a constant example of a Muslim Iranian woman. I tried to always appear with power to show that a woman can be both a mother with all of her emotions and a media soldier with all of her strength. I have never placed limitations on myself. Neither my marriage nor my religion has limited me. Of course, I accept certain rules and structures. It's true that within the Islamic framework and in social interactions, I can accept certain rules, but I don't call them limitations. They have not limited me from having a career as a presenter. I was able to both be a mother and work and be socially active and travel for work while maintaining my modest cover. I've never experienced what you call a limitation. I've been able to be active and work alongside my colleagues as a woman with complete respect and dignity. I believe the women who saw this image were influenced by seeing this way of life. Women I've met from different ages and different walks of life, women from whom I've learned and to whom I've taught a thing or two as well. I'm glad that while fulfilling my role as a mother and an employee, and in the way that I cover and carry myself, I've served as a role model for many.
ظاهر من، کار من، مادر بودن من.
To mainstream media, a woman like you is an example of submission. Submitting to your religion, submitting to the will of your husband, submitting to the Islamic Republic of Iran that you work for. And so can you tell me where this submission leads, that at some point you are the one who's calling the shots?
من مخالف نظر شما هستم.
I disagree. When it comes to my husband's opinion, of course, at times I simply agree with him. And at times we discuss until we reach an agreement together. At the IRIB, I work in a system where at times I tell my managers what needs to be done and they accept my suggestions. I live in a country where much of the time, much of the decisions have been made by women who discussed, insisted, and created a solution. I live and work in a country where women are very much respected, both as mothers at home and as employees at work. They can express their opinions, reach agreements, and call the shots. Also, if you study the history of Iran and its women, about which I suggest that more content is made for the international audience, you'll learn about Iranian women who spoke up in defense of the truth and for the sake of justice. That was not my voice alone. It was the voice of all Iranian women who had for long spoken up in support of the oppressed, for the people of Palestine and Lebanon, and all those who had for long been subjugated by colonizers. The voice of all dignified women throughout Iran's history and that of the world as well.
There were a lot of reactions about your coverage that day. Can you tell us about some of those reactions that stood out to you more?
I have a page on Instagram, and it was interesting for me to see the feedback of my audiences. Some liked a post about my child and wrote that he should be proud of his mother. Many were Iranian expats. They may not have liked my beliefs in the past or may have disliked the way I cover, but it seemed as though what happened brought together people with different opinions and from different backgrounds, like a non-Muslim woman from abroad praising me as a Shia Iranian woman. What happened brought together all those who understood the love for one's country, even those who had felt alienated as a result of political disputes. To me, political disputes are like disputes among family members. These disputes exist in every family and makes the family members grow as individuals. But when the family is threatened by an external enemy, it's beautiful how all the members stand together. And these family members, regardless of their social and political backgrounds, left me heartwarming comments and made me feel that the strength I chose to display that day on air helped people connect with us in defense of our country and all those who fight for it.
Western media has generally connected the phrase Allahu Akbar, or God is the greatest, to terrorist attacks. But you chanted Allahu Akbar at the time where you were attacked. Can you tell us what the significance of that phrase is to you and why you used it?
در ذهن من محکومیت تجاوز بود.
To me, chanting this phrase meant condemning the violations. I wanted to tell our audience that what's happening here is a clear example of injustice. And the phrase, God is the greatest of all, to me was a condemnation of the injustice we faced. Over the years, we heard so much from our audience in different social interactions, and we don't always know how to clarify certain matters from lesser important news to major ones. I had, for instance, heard and myself covered the news of Gaza, but I had never imagined the building I worked in would be hit. When I heard the explosions, it was as though I found the answer for all that had happened in those days for all those who, perhaps, could not really grasp the matter. I wanted to show that it's the concept of God being the greatest that empowers our fighters in the battleground, that it's the chant of innocent women and children who were violated and killed by the enemies. It's the cry of everyone, including those in media, who has been a victim of injustice. It's a call that can unite men and women, young and old. A family sent me a clip of their two-year-old trying to imitate that scene by chanting Allahu Akbar over and over again. It brought me tears of joy to see how phrases I chanted with power because of a belief I hold had had that influence. I wanted my audience to see the injustice we faced. We had never started a war. We had said time and again that we had not wanted a war, that we were people of peace, a nation of debate and diplomacy, but we were violated nevertheless. We We lost 3- and 6-month-old babies. We lost pregnant women. In that, Allahu Akbar, I wanted to confirm the injustice that had taken place, including to those in media who had done nothing but inform and educate people.
As a media person, what was it about what you did that caused fear in the hearts of those who bombed you?
ما کاری نمی کردیم. ما چیزی نداریم. ما تمام تجهیزاتمون خودکار کاغذ.
We hadn't done anything wrong. We had nothing but pens and paper. Those are the only tools of our job. After the building was hit, I turned around and saw a scene that I found very moving. Right there on the shattered glass, news scripts had been scattered everywhere. Scripts for 2 p.m., 4 p.m., 8 a.m. What do we have aside from these? We have cameras that have always been used to cover the reality on the ground. We have journalists who have always tried to reflect the reality. We don't have much but the papers and monitors and equipment to write and edit. My colleagues have broadcasted various images in the last few days. Notes from a journalist, paper, what else was there? Nothing. From the beginning of the Zionist aggression, that is from the dawn of June 13, 2025, we started a special coverage in which we'd discuss and analyze the different aspects of the events. Of course, we reflected the power of Iran. The True Promise operation, which was reflected in the world media more and more by the hour, what was happening was the reflection of the dignity of the Islamic Republic of Iran, the power of the Islamic Republic of Iran, and the strength of its soldiers in the media as well.
There are various international organizations that are charged with human rights, women's rights, journalists' rights. Now, as an Iranian woman who actually went through that experience, have you seen any reaction, any condemnation from those international organizations in the last few days?
Let's look at your question in terms of these words, women, children, and human rights. How much of the violation of their rights was reflected in Gaza, in Lebanon, and in many countries that were victims of violation and injustice? Have any of these violations and attacks been truly condemned? And if there were condemnations, have they really been effective? I used to always ask the guests at our programs a question like what you asked. I'd ask why international organizations and conventions charged with protecting human rights and having taken on that mission are silent in the face of violations of these rights. And once they speak up, why do they only condemn and no practical steps are taken to stop the aggression? I want to say that which was supposed to be done and was not, was overlooked not only in our case, but it's always been overlooked across the world. These simple and passing condemnations have always been there.
So as you said, Sahar Emami doesn't believe that the secret to actually resistance against oppression is negotiations with the U.S. or, you know, appealing to international organizations. So what does Sahar Emami tell people? What would Sahar Emami tell people the secret to resistance is?
It's a heart.
Unity, forming alliances, solidarity. If you have a small circle, it can be broken, but together these circles can form a chain to stop injustice. Together we can stop any and all injustice and oppression. There has been some improvements in the past few years that I've been following international work. I've seen the improvements and how nations have been awakened, whose regimes were terrified of their awakening and they had spent large sums of money to create a generation that would never stand on our side, on the side of the people of Gaza, on the side of Iran's ideals. But despite all their efforts, there were very positive developments. Despite all of these crimes and violations of human rights, we witnessed movements in the heart of America. We witnessed how in the UN, which in many cases was completely silent about the crimes in Gaza, the Zionist regime was called a child-killing regime. We saw that the International Court of Justice condemned the Israeli regime and issued an international verdict for them. These are positive developments. Countries that we didn't expect stood with their nations as they could no longer resist their pressure. And some nations and their leaders stood together for values that belong to the world. Those entities can no longer repeat their heinous deeds. It's true that they have their own supporters, but even those supporters, in my opinion, as someone who's studying international affairs, secretly believe that their end is near because they cannot resist in the face of this awakening, the second wave of which we're witnessing. We had already witnessed protests in the heart of the UK, widespread protests. What brought them about? In Germany, France, and the heart of America, university protests in the US. What caused this? The same events continued until in a new wave, more solidarity was shown. Across the world, the flag of the Islamic Republic was waved even in many European countries, a flag which those people had never waved before. So what made this happen for them to stand with us? I believe it was seeing these violations. Nothing can hide the truth. Nothing can silence the voice of truth. If at a time it does, the truth will later prevail louder and stronger than before. Because in the end, victory is with the truth, and with the countries that don't stand for violation and transgression and oppression.
Thank you very much for sharing with us your message of resistance. And we very much enjoyed sharing this account with you. Stay mindful and spread the message.
This is A to Z. An introduction into an Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the physically impaired helper. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to A to Z here on Iron Bingish Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And obviously it's a slightly long title. And so what am I referring to in particular? So I'm going to refer first of all to just a sort of anecdote from life of the one of the martyrs of the Holy Defense, by the name of Hossein Shayes Defar. So he had, like many martyrs, he had actually sustained serious injuries at the front. So he was. But however, even though he had been sort of severely injured and he actually found walking difficult, he still insisted on doing most of the shopping for his wife. And not only that, he would also help her with the housework. So obviously, just sort of picture this to yourselves, because obviously we. Maybe some of you have been in that situation where you're not so mobile, and yet you still want to help. Some people have maybe been in the situation where they're not so mobile and they just cannot physically do anything, even to get out the door, just even if it's just literally a few meters walk down to a shop, and even that they can't do. But obviously it's a for this martyr, so for the spouse to be pushing himself, somehow coping with this, still doing this, making this physical effort to help his wife. Because of course, we know that in Islam, a woman isn't obliged to do any of the housework, though in reality, most women will sort of happily do it anyway. But obviously he... despite his injuries, wanted to help out so much. So obviously this is it's a high level of selflessness, to some extent, most likely also sort of putting up with a degree of pain. But obviously there's another aspect in there too, which I'll mention. Welcome back to A to Z here on Iron Bingish Radio with me, Sister Zainab. And so I was just talking about an anecdote from life of one of the martyrs from the Holy Defense by the name of Hossein Shayes Defar, who, despite being injured and finding walking difficult, would still help his wife with shopping, or actually do the shopping for his wife and help with the housework. And I mentioned there's another aspect to this, and this is obviously the spouse, the martyr in this case, I suppose also just appreciating his wife and the status of his wife so much. So appreciating the dignity and the role of the wife so much that he wanted to obviously help out and I suppose make her life easier. And you know what, and this idea of self-sacrifice, so have maybe some of us have been in a situation where, you know, and I would always think of the mothers who, despite illness or let's say a sort of injury, for example, I know a mother who has four children, and every so often an old injury in the foot would sort of escalate again and produce severe pain where she really can only walk by limping, but she would still she would still try to walk her children to school, she would still be doing the chores in the house, she would still be doing the shopping and so on. Obviously, you just have to be very, very, very slow, but still do this. And, you know, so that's just one example of it. Many mothers, obviously, are like that. But then, obviously, we have, you know, the husbands, the fathers might also behave like that. Other family members might also do that. And, you know, so the idea is that, you know, we sort of go over and above ourselves to help, even if, you know, at times it's not easy for us. And that not being easy could just be maybe we don't have that much time. Maybe we're really busy. But maybe we just want to go over and above to help others and just give them our time. If we've got nothing else to give, at least give time, even if it is a bit of an inconvenience for us. So inshallah, these are reminders for us and, you know, how else we can improve ourselves. And I look forward